or the amount of some particle chi that we have. And if we want this particle chi to be dark matter, then we found that there's a very nice way that this can happen. It can happen if it's a thermal relic. And basically, it's in equilibrium, and then its annihilations freeze out, and you're just left with some amount of it. Okay? And this led us to the Wimp miracle, which told us that if we want this chi particle to be dark matter, its mass should be around the weak scale, and it should have some large coupling associated with it. And then this led us to our discussion last week of direct and indirect detection. Basically, the fact that we have these new particles, which are in energy ranges that experiments are currently probing, that have relatively large coupling. So even though it's weak in the sense of it doesn't interact visibly through electromagnetism, these are things that we can actually go and look for. So the ones we talked explicitly about are if this dark matter particle comes and collides with some nucleus in an experiment that you have, you can look for that nuclear recoil. We saw that that was very constraining for certain types of interactions. And then there was this complementary search strategy, which was indirect detection, which was looking for the products of chi-chi bar to standard model annihilation in the present-day halo. We saw that that constrains sort of some of the interactions that we couldn't get at through direct detection. And there are a few other means of detection. So you can try and produce at the LHC. There are other possibilities for indirect detection, signatures of annihilation, say, in the cosmic microwave background or other things. But the point is that for all of these things, there are experiments that either have constrained the parameter space or will constrain the parameter space. So that we have a pretty good sense that if WIMP dark matter is there, we'll probably be able to see some evidence for it, either in the current crop of experiments or the next generation of experiments. So did any of you have any specific questions about either direct or indirect detection that we talked about last week? Okay, so all of the bounds, the particular bounds depend on astrophysical assumptions and various things that you can change by order one numbers, but that's the general story for WIMP dark matter. Okay? So the fact that we haven't seen any evidence for WIMP dark matter, and there's the possibility that we won't see any evidence for WIMP dark matter, leads us to think about, well, what happens if this whole story is wrong? Because this is, of course, a very compelling way of thinking about dark matter, and for a long time it was the preferred way of thinking about dark matter, but there's nothing in nature that guarantees that it's going to be as nice as the first theory that we write down. And so we want to think about what are some other possibilities. So that's going to be the topic of today's lecture and part of tomorrow's lecture as well. So the idea behind non-thermal dark matter is basically what happens if we break the first assumption of this whole framework, which is that dark matter had to be in equilibrium at some early time. So what if dark matter just never came into equilibrium? So if dark matter never came into equilibrium, then the whole freeze-out picture just doesn't happen. Freeze-out requires some rapid dark matter annihilation, and then at a certain point, its number density gets exponentially depleted. And so it was this exponential depletion of the dark matter density that required very large couplings. Okay? We needed, because we know that n chi equilibrium goes like e to the minus m chi over t for non-relativistic. So in order to get the correct amount of dark matter, we needed this exponential to be quite small. We needed it to be something like e to the minus 25 or e to the minus 30. Okay? And in order for annihilation to be efficient to these very late times to get the right dark matter density, this is what led to large couplings, etc. So if I cross out this whole picture, then I no longer need the order one couplings, and so my direct and indirect detection experiments probably won't see anything. Okay? So how does this work? Is there some other favored region of parameter space like the WIMP parameter space, but for non-thermal dark matter, and if so, how do we see it? Okay. So if we want to draw schematically, the thermal dark matter picture is basically this line here, what we've already been talking about. This is thermal dark matter. Non-thermal dark matter looks more like this. It doesn't ever come into equilibrium. Its curve never corresponds to the equilibrium one. It just happens to find the right abundance somehow. Now, it turns out that the theories are going to be messier for non-thermal dark matter. And part of the reason for this is just that dark matter coming to equilibrium sort of hits the reset button on the initial conditions of dark matter. It doesn't matter if dark matter started out here, here, or whatever. It always gets pushed to the equilibrium value. And so you can make very model-independent predictions about what thermal dark matter is doing. Whereas for non-thermal dark matter, you're sensitive to the entire history of dark matter. So you don't just care about what happens at the time of thermal freeze-out like we were for thermal dark matter. You need to integrate over very long timescales. And so any possible changes to what's going on with your cosmology can affect your non-thermal abundance. Okay. And then we'll also find that in order for gamma, which was basically the equilibrium number density times sigma v, for this to be smaller than Hubble generally implies small couplings. And this is not nice from the point of view that if we have small couplings, then all of our rates associated with dark matter are smaller, and so all of our experiments become insensitive to these things. So there are a few names that are given to non-thermal dark matter candidates. So among them, we have super WIMPs, which I think is pretty deceptive because it's super weakly interacting massive particle, but it makes me think of something that like probably interacts more. So I don't really use super WIMP. There's also FIMP, which is a feebly interacting massive particle. There are WISPs, which are weakly interacting skits. So there are a whole bunch of possible things. I'm just going to call them non-thermal dark matter. But depending on who came up with what name, you probably want to use that name when you're giving a talk at their institution. So it's good to be familiar with some of the things that when you see them in a paper, you're like, oh, they're just talking about non-thermal dark matter. Okay. All right. So there are two basic mechanisms. And also in the literature, it's a little bit confusing because it's not organized this way. Often people pick particular particles in their models. They talk about sterile neutrinos, or they talk about gravitinos, or they talk about whatever. But the basic underlying physical mechanisms for producing the amount of dark matter boils down to two or three mechanisms. So we'll talk about two of those. And hopefully this will give you the tools that you need to understand those more specific models when you see them. So the first one is something that's called thermal freeze-in. Okay, it's the opposite of thermal freeze-out. And if you look at this plot, this is sort of typical of what you expect from a thermal freeze-in. So instead of thermal freeze-out, where you're trying to follow some equilibrium distribution and you just aren't able to track the curve anymore, with freeze-in, the idea is that you never reach equilibrium, but there's some slow scatterings that very slowly populate your dark matter, and so you end up with some very small non-equilibrium abundance of them. So this still takes place, so this still comes from scatterings with thermal bath, except instead of coming into equilibrium, you just create just enough dark matter, and then you never annihilate. It just stays there. Okay, and then the second one is called vacuum misalignment production of dark matter. And this is extremely non-thermal in the sense that you don't even need to have scattering with a thermal bath in order to produce dark matter. This just comes from the classical dynamics of your whatever field is your dark matter particle. So here it's like the most non-thermal that you can probably imagine, because you don't even have any finite temperature interactions taking place in it. Okay. So let's get started with thermal freeze-in. So this idea has been around for a while. I think John McDonald is one of the first people to bring out the idea. And then in 2009, Lawrence Hall had a paper where they elaborated all of the possibilities. And so this was sort of some of the first model-independent castings of this idea. But for freeze-in, unlike freeze-out, gamma is less than h always. So basically, n chi is never n chi equilibrium. But gamma is not zero. Gamma is still something. So you still have some rate of production that goes through standard model bar to chi, chi bar, say. So this is the same diagram that you had for thermal freeze-out, but flipped. And this is standard model particles scattering into dark matter. And this rate is always less than Hubble, but it's not zero. And because it's not zero, you're going to be creating some amount of dark matter. So if you like, you're using the same Boltzmann equation, except this n chi is very small relative to n chi equilibrium. Okay. So this term represents the standard model scattering into chi. And this is chi scattering into the standard model. Okay. So there's a question of how much dark matter do we get as a function of gamma over H. Okay, so the rough estimate comes from the fact that if gamma is equal to H, then n chi is just its equilibrium number density. So what this is saying is that if the scatterings are fast enough that every particle scatters in one Hubble time, then you're going, each of these standard model particles is going to produce one chi, and you're going to end up with essentially the same number of chis as you end up with standard model particles. So if our equilibrium condition is met, then the number density is equal to the equilibrium number density. So if gamma is less than H, it basically just scales linearly. So the non-thermal number density is just the sum over all Hubble times of n chi equilibrium times gamma over H. So it's basically you're just weighting it by this factor of gamma over H. So if gamma over H is 1, you end up with exactly the equilibrium number density. And if gamma is less than 1, then you're producing some small number of chi as a relative to the equilibrium number density. So here we're making the very crude approximation. So how do we get this? So the number of scatterings per particle, this basically goes like the integral of gamma over time. So gamma is a rate, it has the dimensions of 1 over time. So gamma times time tells us the number of scatterings per particle. But of course, time is just 1 over the Hubble scale. So this is approximately goes like gamma over H. Now, we're making some assumption that gamma doesn't change over the Hubble time and H doesn't change over Hubble time, which is a crude approximation. But it gets us to within the right order of magnitude because it allows us to estimate it. The idea is that during one, sort of as the universe doubles once, there's some characteristic rate associated with the scattering. And you can figure out how many dark matter particles do I produce in that time. And then I sort of reset everything. I recalculate gamma and H, and I do it again. And the reason why this setup is nice is because typically gamma over H is largest at one particular point in time. This is a general feature of these models. So even though this scattering is taking place through the universe's entire history, the total amount of dark matter that you get is mostly determined by basically one instant or one Hubble time. Okay. So this, it's basically you can think of it as sort of a dimensional analysis estimate of your dark matter thermal abundance. Okay. Yes?
Does this hold better for small gamma or large gamma?
It holds better for gamma that doesn't depend too sharply on the temperature. Okay. So if gamma scales like T to the 20, then this is probably a bad assumption because in one Hubble time, the rate changes enormously. If gamma scales like temperature, then it's only going like the square root of Hubble, and so it's a reasonable approximation. So I'd say that's probably
right. I was just thinking, because if gamma and H are too similar, then there's a risk that this will be, you'll predict more than the equilibrium.
That's right. So we're making the implicit assumption that n chi is, gamma is always less than H, and n chi never reaches equilibrium. So what that's telling you is that you don't actually have non-thermal dark matter, and then you should revert to the thermal picture. But that's a good question. You don't want a naive application of this. But we're assuming really that this is always much smaller than H. Because, of course, we're integrating over many Hubble times. So if gamma is always 0.5 H, then after two Hubble times are in equilibrium. Okay, so then it's not non-thermal, really. So are there any other questions about the rate versus Hubble? I mean, it's a it might be a little bit surprising if you haven't seen it before, but yeah, let me know if there's anything that's confusing you about it. Okay. So we'll take our, so I'll take this process and I'll write it a little more explicitly. So if I write a Feynman diagram, it's going to look something like my standard model FF bar. There's going to be some mediator, which I'll call phi. And then I'm going to have my chi and chi bar. So what I want is my rate of production, which is basically n chi equilibrium sigma v. That just comes from the Boltzmann equation. That's the same rate we've been using all along. So I need to estimate sigma v from this process. And so this is something that we've done a few times. So there are going to be two couplings here associated with each of these interactions. Okay. And then I'm going to have a propagator associated with the intermediate state. So I'm going to have something that goes like m. This is going to go like g squared over whatever the momentum, so let's call this p, minus m phi squared. And the matrix element for 2 to 2 scattering is actually dimensionless, and so there's going to be some factor of p squared in the numerator as well. Okay. That's the typical momentum that's flowing through this diagram. So if I actually worked through and I did all of my traces of my external wave functions, I would end up with something that looks like this. Okay. So if I so this tells me that sigma v, which scales like m squared, is going to go something like g to the fourth p squared. So remember, this has dimensions of energy to the minus 2. Now you can ask, what's the typical momentum? And because these scatterings are still coming from fermions that are in the thermal bath, so chi is non-thermal, but your fermions are still sitting in the thermal bath, the fermion momentum is going to be of order of the temperature. Okay. That's pretty much the only dimensionful quantity that we have. So our sigma v is basically going to go like coupling to the fourth p squared. Right, okay. But then remember that in our definition of sigma, there's a 1 over s. There's our 1 over incoming momentum squared, right? So but basically, I have two energy scales in the problem. I have the temperature and I have the mass of the propagator, or the mass of the intermediate field, right? So the characteristic energy, it comes purely from the F momentum, and then you also just happen to have this M phi sitting here, right? Does that make sense? Okay. So it's a little bit confusing. I should probably just shouldn't have written out the matrix element, because the matrix element, the cross section just doesn't depend on that. It also depends on some other powers of momentum. Okay. So what this allows me to do is that I can now figure out the dependence of gamma. So I'm going to assume that chi is relativistic. Okay. If chi isn't non-relativistic, then this process isn't really kinematically allowed anyway. Because this means that m chi is less than, sorry, m chi is bigger than the temperature. So non-relativistic means that m chi is bigger than the temperature, but the characteristic energy of the incoming state is the temperature, so you just don't have enough energy to make it go. Okay. So this thing only really happens when chi is relativistic anyway. So if chi isn't relativistic, if we think back to our equilibrium formula, this is equal to some constant times t cubed. Yes. So this really comes from It's the Boltzmann equation, yeah. So it comes from the fact that essentially this, that if chi is, so if the temperature of these incoming states is less than the mass of chi, then you're paying a penalty from the fact that you need this, you sort of need an extra amount of energy concentrated in here. So that pays a factor of e to the minus energy over temperature. But it basically follows from the manipulations that you did in the problem set, where you use conservation of energy and convert the F distributions into chi distributions. Okay, so N goes like T cubed, sigma V goes like coupling to the fourth T squared over T squared minus M phi squared squared. So gamma goes like, G to the fourth, T to the fifth over this propagator squared. And so what we want to do is we want to compare this to the Hubble scale, because we see that it's gamma relative to the Hubble scale that tells us how close we are to coming into equilibrium. Okay, so we can also use the fact that Hubble scale is like, or it's proportional to T squared over M Planck. So this is just the collection of results that we basically derived elsewhere in the course. So our final thing that we find is that gamma over H is proportional to G to the fourth T cubed M Planck over T squared minus M phi squared all squared. So this is just a bit of algebra and dimensional analysis essentially. But what we want to do is figure out that this gamma over H is changing as a function of temperature, and we conjecture that gamma over H is biggest at basically one particular point in the universe's evolution. So what this allows us to do is it allows us to estimate when is that true. Okay. When is gamma over H maximized, essentially? Okay, so there are two possible limits that we can take for this equation. So the limit A is what we'll call the contact interaction limit. And what defines the contact interaction limit is that the mass of the mediator is much bigger than the energy of this process, okay? So this is true, we can just say, okay, well, if T is much smaller than M phi, I just keep the M phi term in there. And what I end up with is gamma over H is proportional to basically T cubed M Planck over M phi to the fourth. Okay. So I can ask, what's happening with this as the universe evolves? And you can see that as the temperature gets smaller, my gamma over H gets smaller. T goes to zero. And since my number density basically scales like the ratio of gamma over H, what this is telling me is that my N chi is biggest, or is produced most, at large T. So basically, if I want gamma over H to be equal, that's true for the, it's more true as my temperature goes up. Okay. So the question then is, well, what is the biggest T? And this is something that's essentially, yes, Kiri.
Surely gamma over H is biggest when T equals M phi, so the bottom goes up.
Okay, sure. So if we're really careful, we'll put in some width associated with the mediator. But if we assume that, say, that width is large, then we don't necessarily end up with a resonant enhancement. Okay. This is necessarily kind of sketchy, just because I'm trying to show the general scaling. But you're right, the same games that you can play with thermal dark matter, you can also play with non-thermal dark matter, where if you happen to have states that are close together, you can pass through resonance, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, so for this particular example, if m phi is always larger than the temperature, then you never hit a resonance. Okay. In the other case, I'll explain what that means when you're on resonance. Okay. Okay, you make a good point. And we will show in the next section that actually it's maximized when t is m phi anyway, independent of these resonance conditions. Okay. So what we see is that in this contact interaction limit, so basically, if we have a very heavy mediator, then I produce most of my dark matter at the highest possible temperature. So the question is, what is the highest possible temperature? So generally, this T max is something we call T reheat. So after inflation, basically the inflation resets the universe to some empty state, and then the inflaton decays. And the inflaton decay creates some characteristic temperature, which is called the reheat temperature. And then the universe just expands and reduces the temperature. So this is just an observation that the universe expansion always makes it go colder instead of hotter, unless you have some weird process that's happening. So you can think of this as basically an initial condition, that inflation resets the state of the universe and then produces some thermal bath with temperature reheat. And so this limit is valid as long as m phi is bigger than, say, T reheat. Okay, so what does this all mean? This means that my dark matter abundance in this scenario depends on the highest possible scale, energy scale in my theory. Okay. So basically, dark matter is entirely produced right after inflation, and then afterwards it just becomes less and less important. So in some ways, this is hardest because this is extremely UV sensitive. This doesn't really depend on any of my low energy physics. It just depends on my high energy physics. Okay. All right, so we can make an estimate for what kinds of parameters we need, so like what this coupling needs to be, what this temperature needs to be. And we can do that by saying, okay, well, the total number density is basically the equilibrium number density at T reheat times gamma at T reheat over H at T reheat. And so, and this scaling just goes like this. This is proportional to Y equilibrium T reheat. G to the fourth T reheat cubed M Planck over M phi to the fourth. Okay. So if I want this to be equal to Y dark matter, which is about 4 × 5·10⁻¹⁰ for chi of GeV. So this is just taking some of the numerical relationships that we've already shown. Then we can come up with some example parameters that make this work. So for instance, if T reheat is 10 to the 10 GeV, which is sort of a nice intermediate value, if m chi is about 100 GeV, like you would expect for Wimp dark matter, then this gives me a value of G over m phi is equal to 8 × 10⁻¹⁶ inverse GeV. Okay. So what this is telling you is that my m phi has to be really heavy, and this coupling has to be really small in order to get the right amount of dark matter. And this just follows from taking this formula and plugging in the numeric, okay, which I'm not going to do explicitly on the board. So we see that the hallmark is tiny couplings, heavy mediator, and it depends sensitively on your initial conditions. So this is pretty crappy from the perspective of detection, just because you need to both have a small coupling. And so if this coupling is order one, this mediator is basically up at the gut scale. It's extremely suppressed. So if all of my processes nowadays are going to go like energy of my experiment over m phi, if I'm trying to probe this m phi. So you'll see that you could quite easily get dark matter. And it just needs to be this very tiny coupling that I might not see in any other experiment. So there's some examples in the literature of this. So one example in the literature is what's called gravitino dark matter. And it's basically the a supersymmetric particle. It's the supersymmetric partner of the graviton. And because it's a supersymmetric partner of the graviton, its interactions typically go like, you know, powers of M Planck to something. Okay. So this is exactly in this contact limit. Okay. So there are examples of this in the literature, but it's very, very hard to see. Okay. So are there any questions about this particular limit or the scaling in this scenario? Okay. So the other possibility is the on-shell limit. So this is what you get if M phi is smaller than T reheat. So what this means is that there are temperatures at which M phi is negligible in that equation. And so I can do the exact same thing where I take this here and I simply just say, okay, I'm gonna neglect M phi in this expression. What do I end up with? Yes,
so now that we have a measurement of arc and bicep, does this tell us anything about T reheat, or is it still model dependent?
It's still model dependent. So the natural thing would be that T reheat is approximately the Hubble scale. So then that would be a very high reheat temperature. But basically, it depends a lot on what the coupling of the inflaton is, because the reheat temperature basically depends on the inflaton width. Okay, so basically, even if you have a large Hubble scale, maybe the inflaton has some very tiny coupling, and so that can reduce the reheat temperature, for instance. So it gives you some suggestion of where it might be. So, but and so obviously, if you make the reheat temperature different, then you'll change this prediction somehow. Okay. But what it doesn't change is the fact that if my reheat temperature goes up, then my minimum M phi also goes up. And so maybe I can have slightly bigger couplings, but my field is still really heavy. That's a very good question. Okay, so we'll take this equation and we'll take the limit that T is basically bigger than the mediator mass. So if this is the case, then my gamma over H just reduces to M Planck over the temperature. Okay, because we have a t cubed in the numerator, a t to the fourth in the denominator. We know this M Planck has to be here from the Hubble scale, and so you can basically just line up the rest of your energy scales by dimensional analysis. So this is the opposite. This is a large gamma over h as t goes to zero, or larger, I should say. So unlike the contact limit, if you actually have on-shell mediators, then your gamma over H grows as the temperature gets smaller. Of course, once the temperature drops below M phi, you get back into this scenario where you actually have gamma over H is bigger for a higher temperature. So what this tells you, if I combine the two limits, so gamma over H is maximal at T equals the mass of the mediator. Okay. So what this is saying is that, and we can try and understand this intuitively, which is that as the temperature drops, your Hubble scale, which scales like T squared, the Hubble scale is getting smaller faster than your gamma. So even though your rate is decreasing, your Hubble scale is decreasing by an extra power. Okay, so what this is essentially saying is that the expansion time of the universe, which is 1 over Hubble, is getting longer as times go, as the universe expands further. So if we can kind of wait until longer and longer periods in the universe's evolution, then each typical expansion time just takes longer. So I'm integrating this gamma over a longer period of time. Okay. So this tends to prefer actually temperatures that are around the mass of the mediator. Once I drop below the mass of the mediator, I pick up this extra T over M phi suppression, and that changes the scaling of everything. So I really want to live in this range. All right. Okay, so we do the same thing where basically y chi at infinity is approximately y chi equilibrium at t equals m phi times gamma of t equals m phi, where h of t equals m phi. And now this is the point that Kieran was suggesting earlier, which is that when phi is on shell, we have this 2 to 2 process, which is ff bar chi chi bar. But so this scales like g to the fourth. But we also just have a 1 to 2 process, which is phi decaying into chi chi bar. And this goes like g squared. Okay. So when phi is on shell, technically we can produce dark matter through 2 to 2 scattering and also through 1 to 2 decays. And if my g is small, which we've already seen is probably going to be true, this is actually the part that wins out. And if you like, the resonant scattering process is essentially the same as if I produce this phi and the phi decays. Okay. So I think that's probably the answer to that question. So all of the parametrics are the same. Except you basically replace g to the fourth with a g squared everywhere. Okay. So if I plug that into my equation, I can do another, you know, example numerics. What I find is that if m chi is about 100 GeV, then g is about 10 to the minus 11. And there's no dependence on T reheat. Because as we saw, during this epoch where the temperature is much bigger than m phi, the rate actually gets bigger as the temperature goes down. So what's nice about this is that we lose some of the UV sensitivity. We can make much more concrete predictions. The downside of it is that the coupling is still very, very small. Okay, 10 to the minus 11 is a hard thing to find. Because of course, most processes that we're doing now scale like 10 to the minus 11 to, and this is, if m phi is, say, around the same scale. So most processes we're looking at now will go like 10 to the minus 11 to the fourth. Yes, Kieran.
With regards to those two processes, what do we know about the number densities of the x and the phi's to know that the right-hand process is different? Because it could be
faster. Right, so the point is that they both turn around at the same point. Okay, so both of these things peak at t equals m phi and then get smaller again. It's just, this one will go like e to the minus m phi over t because you have to have some phi's lying around. This one won't. But at the maximum point, this is just a number of order 1. Okay. So then if I take 10 to the minus 11 and I say 10 to the minus 11 squared versus 10 to the minus 11 to the fourth, okay. So this exponential has to be really small for that to win out. Okay. So it's probably best if you don't get too bogged down in these models, because what makes these things challenging is these extremely small couplings. So the general strategies for Friesen detection, so we want, let's say this is actually what happens and we want to figure out that this is what's happening. Looking for this coupling is probably a very bad idea. Okay, we need to have a very sensitive experiments in order for that to work. So some things that we can do are look for associated states. So for instance, we can hope that this mediator has a larger coupling to other standard model fields than to dark matter. So that maybe we can't see this process, but we can see, you know, FF bar goes to FF bar, something like that. And this is a very model-dependent statement, because if I am giving you a model of, you know, sterile neutrinos, then I'm specifying exactly what my mediators are and exactly what the underlying physics is. And so then that gives you some benchmark that you can shoot for how can you see this mediator rather, you know, not through this very tiny coupling, but through something else. But this is unfortunately model-dependent. So the other thing that you can do is you can say, well, before we had to impose this Z2 symmetry to forbid dark matter decay. Because dark matter had order one couplings. So the reasoning was, if you have order one couplings and you don't have some good reason why dark matter doesn't decay, it will probably decay. Because it has to live for an extremely long time. But now we have these very, very small couplings. So now there's the possibility that dark matter can decay through these tiny couplings. But just when I calculate gamma chi, which is basically the characteristic time scale of time decay, this is much bigger than the age of the universe. Okay. So now that we're not restricting ourselves to order one coupling, it might be that this Z2 symmetry is just sort of an accidental thing. It's not actually a real symmetry of my theory, but the only couplings that mediate these decays are very, very small numbers. And so the smallness of the coupling means that I have no indirect detection. This chi-chi bar to FF bar is going to be so small that I'm just never going to see it. But I might be able to see in my indirect detection experiment some evidence for dark matter decay. Now, once again, this is a very model-dependent statement. Again, the reason is that the interactions I've written down don't cause dark matter to decay. So I need to have my full theory to see whether these interactions mediate dark matter decay. But it does change the model consideration somewhat. And so it's much more, because we already have some small numbers in our theory, it's much more plausible that you have some kind of decaying dark matter in a non-thermal dark matter story. So these are basically the best ways you can look for this. And neither of them are ideal, but what they do is they expand the range of possible theories of what dark matter could be and how we could be looking for it. So now this sort of simple model that I wrote down, it's not even really a model, it's just a parameterization of the different particles. No one would go and build an experiment to look for this, but if you embed it in some other model that has some nice properties and you can make a very concrete prediction from, you know, model dependent, but a reasonable prediction, then maybe experiments will go and look for it. Okay. And indeed, there are experiments that look for instance, the decay of dark matter that's like this. So unfortunately, the punchline for this is less nice, but this is sort of the world that we're entering as we continue to exclude more of the WIMP model parameter space and we don't see anything. Okay. And of course, there's sort of some continuity between these models and just initial conditions where I just say, okay, this is my amount of dark matter that I start out with. There's a very, very kind of not clear line between some non-thermal dark matter models and just specifying the dark matter density from initial conditions. So are there any questions about thermal freeze-in or the different scenarios that we considered? Okay. So the second production mechanism is through what's called vacuum misalignment. And this is a very interesting scenario because you essentially have no dark matter standard model thermal scatterings that are relevant for the dark matter abundance. So it's not even freeze-in. If you calculate the sort of freeze-in contribution, it's relatively negligible. So basically, what you find is that if you have some scalar fields in your theory, then there's some associated potential for the scalar field. And the scalar fields like to go into their lowest energy state. They basically go into the minimum of the potential. And it turns out that this desire for fields to always go into their lowest energy state, if you have something funny going on with the potential, can actually create drive the creation of some energy density in these scalar fields that looks exactly like cold dark matter. So you can't really think of it in the same way as it's as you're scattering and producing particles, but it's sort of the shifts of these fields from their sort of initial positions into the minima, that this energy density can give you dark matter. So I'll explain to you in a little bit more detail how that works. So suppose we have a theory with a global U1 symmetry. It can really be any continuous symmetry, but we'll stick to U1 just so that it's simple. And we have some scalars, and we have some fermions. We have some other particles that are charged under this theory. But the key point is that it's a global symmetry. It's not a gauge symmetry. And this can come generically out of string theory or whatever your favorite UV theory is. Okay, so if the vacuum, so I have the minimum of the of scalar potential, for some field phi in my theory, so this is some field that's charged under the U1. So if basically this happened, the minimum is not at phi equals zero, then it means that the vacuum of the theory is not manifestly showing this symmetry. We say that this is a spontaneously broken U1 symmetry. And an example of a potential that will do this is just something that looks like this. So if you plug in phi is equal to zero, say, then I have V of phi is some number. But if I plug in phi is equal to F, then my energy is actually zero. Okay. So what this means is that the vacuum of my theory actually prefers the this scalar to have a non-zero value associated with it. So have you all seen spontaneous symmetry breaking before? Okay. So this just looks like the Higgs potential, except this isn't a Higgs, it's a global U1 symmetry. So it's some analog of it. Okay, so we have a spontaneously broken symmetry, and so how do we want to expand this field around its new vacuum. So what we do is we define two other fields. So we break this capital phi into a little phi, and a field that we'll call A. Okay. And now if so we see that performing a U1 transformation on phi, it takes phi goes to say some e to the I theta times phi. Okay, this is just the definition of a U1 transformation. So we see that in terms of the decomposed fields, V1 takes as little phi, it doesn't change it at all, and it takes A into A plus F times this angle. Okay. So basically all of the U1 transformations come in as shifts of this field A. So now what does the spectrum look like? So phi is just some massive scalar with mass that's about F. You'll see that if you just plug it in. I mean, in some sense, F is the only number that we have in our theory. So, however, A is what we call a Goldstone boson. It's massless completely. And a way that we can see that it's massless is that we know that the full theory is invariant under these U1 transformations. But a U1 transformation just takes A to A plus a constant. So if I write down some term that's like ma squared a squared, then this gets transformed to ma squared a plus f theta squared. These things are not the same. Okay. So if this U1 is an actual symmetry of my theory, then A has this shift symmetry, and it turns out that A can only have derivative interactions. Why? Well, because the derivative of A plus a constant is the same as the derivative of A. And the derivative is really the only function that does that for all values of the constant. So your theory can have interactions that are like d mu A times a bunch of stuff, but you can't actually have just A. And this prevents A from having any mass whatsoever. Okay. So for example, suppose I have some other fields that have a fermion psi and a scalar S. My only allowed interactions are things that look like d mu A psi bar gamma mu psi, d mu A S dagger d mu S, etc. This just follows from Lorentz invariance. I need to have a derivative on the A, which gives me this Lorentz index mu. So I need to find some other thing with a mu to contract it with. And this is a derivative. Okay. And if you add up the dimensions of these things, you'll find that they add up to more than 4, right? Because so this derivative has dimension 1. Scalar field has dimension 1. We have 2 fermions with dimensions of 2 halves. So this is actually a non-renormalizable interaction. This has dimensions larger than 4, and so there's actually this 1 over f sitting up front. Same thing here. This derivative has dimension 1, this has dimension 1, this has dimension 1, this derivative has dimension 1, that has dimension 1. So I also need to have some 1 over f to make the dimensions of my Lagrangian 4. Okay? So now we can say, well, what happens to these fields? So So at t close to, but not too far below f, then maybe I'll draw out this picture. So if I draw out this potential, it looks something. This is going to be really bad. Okay. Looks sort of like this. Well, maybe I'll. Have you all seen the Mexican hat potential before? Okay. So the idea is that this potential looks like this, where you have some vacuum that runs in a circle along here. So at temperatures around F, the field finds itself down in the minimum. Okay. So you end up with this massive scalar and a massless Goldstone boson. The massless scalar doesn't have, you know, it can just couple directly to everything. So the number density of F is just basically equal to its equilibrium number density. And then A. So this is M phi over T, which basically was like F over T. Okay. A is some relativistic particle in the bath. So NA is just, you know, goes like T cubed. But then at T much, much smaller than F, this, because M phi goes like F, the number density of your phis is basically 0. It's some very heavy field. And so when the temperature drops below its mass, it just vanishes from the bath. It just decays into standard model particles. Okay, so this is phi. What about A? Well, we've just shown in what we've done with non-thermal dark matter that if I have some interaction that's suppressed by some heavy mass scale, all of these scattering rates are going to go sort of like T squared over F squared. So all of these things are going to get small because the interaction rates are suppressed by this 1 over very large mass scale. So this A is just going to decouple from the thermal bath. So it's some relativistic radiation, and it just decouples from the thermal bath, and then it just does its own thing for the rest of the universe's history. So are there any questions about the behavior of these respective particles at different temperatures, so as the bath cools down? Okay, so far this is pretty uninteresting because I told you that I wanted dark matter, and so we want some new contribution to the energy density. And so we've introduced two new particles, but one of them basically has no number density anymore. It's exponentially suppressed. The other one is some relativistic field. It's massless, so it's basically just like some other photon in your bath. So that also doesn't give me dark matter, and that's relatively unconstrained by current things. So this has not changed the thermal history of my universe from the standard model at all. Okay, so this is pretty uninteresting. So how do we get dark matter? And since we're running out of time, I won't go into it right now. We'll save the rest of the analysis for tomorrow. But what's basically going to happen is we're going to say, well, what if this U1 symmetry is not exactly preserved? What if the U1 is broken by a little bit? Then this A is not exactly massless. So it had this vacuum structure where the A has zero energy all the way around here. But if my symmetry is broken, then it means that there's actually a point, say this point, just to be arbitrary. So this is the true vacuum. So originally I was not, if the energy difference between these different points is very small, I'm initially not sensitive to this. Okay? So this whole circle looks like my vacuum. And so at early times, I can find my A here or here or here or here. But at late times, I become sensitive to the fact that there's actually a very small gradient. There's actually a minimum of the potential sitting right there. And what that's going to do is it means, let me sort of draw it out. So this is sort of the cross-sectional picture. We're going to take A and V of A. Originally, we thought it was just flat. But it's actually going to be very, very slightly curved. And this is going to be the true minimum of the potential. Now, if I was very fortunate, then maybe the A that I ended up with after symmetry breaking is sitting right here, in which case nothing happens. I'm still in the true vacuum, and this uninteresting story is the thermal history. But if I'm not, if I happen to be sitting somewhere out here, then I actually have some finite energy in my A fields. And it turns out the equations of motion are basically the same as a ball rolling in a gravitational potential. So what's going to happen is my field is going to evolve down into the minimum. Except if I have a ball that's rolling in the minimum of valley, say, it's not just going to stop there. It's going to go up, and then it's going to turn around, and it's going to come back. So it's going to just oscillate around the minimum of its potential. And what we'll show is that the energy that's stored in this is basically scales exactly the same way as cold dark matter. So from the perspective of GR, it's some pressureless contribution to my energy momentum tensor. And so what we're going to find out is that actually it's this moving between where you happen to be, you know, where you thought the vacuum was and where the vacuum actually is going to give you your dark matter density. Yes.
So you told us that A has a shift symmetry.
Mm-hmm. So I mentioned that what we're going to consider is the case where the symmetry is explicitly broken by some small thing. Sorry, I should have written that on the board. But because we're breaking the symmetry, instead of it being invariant, there's some special point here that's going to be the bottom of my potential. Yeah.
So when the spontaneous symmetry breaking happens, even if it's a proximal symmetry, are we going to produce a topological tensor?
That's a good question. So you typically do. And that actually provides an alternate production mechanism for axions where those topological defects can decay. But I'm not going to talk about that. So that is actually not under very good calculational control. There's a lot of controversy right now about how many this scenario is most often applied to something called an axion. But you can get it through any U1 symmetry, and we don't really know what the answer for that is. So the claims in the literature are vary by two orders of magnitude. So But this is something that is a well-defined, it's just classical field theory, essentially. So tomorrow we'll figure out, we'll formalize this a little bit, and what's neat about this is that it's very non-thermal. Like, there's no scattering, there's no production of any A particles going on. It's actually just energy that's stored in the field, and it turns out that this energy manifests itself as some condensate of cold bosons, essentially, massive bosons. So, and we'll show that this can give you the dark matter abundance. Okay. All right, so are there any questions about this? Otherwise, we'll keep going tomorrow. Great, thanks.